sort of Yevtushenko, because he was a bad poet and journalist of self-advertiser, and because he's rather in with the regime. And Brzezinski was a better poet. Akhmatova detested them both. However, this person I asked to be there, they couldn't keep them away. They came, and they sat on either side of Akhmatova with divinity in their eyes. They were terribly nervous of meeting. But by this time, she's regarded as unapproachable, sort of marvelous, wonderful person. And out of sheer nerves, according to Madame Tomaszewska, they got drunk. They were drinking drunkards anyway. And she talked to them as far as she could, not very willingly, not very enthusiastically. And then she left to go, rather before she need have done. And they accompanied her to the top of the staircase, which she had to go down, more or less as escorts. And suddenly, they were sent hurtling downstairs, both of them. Sent absolutely thrown downstairs, one on top of the other, by a mighty hand. And whose mighty hand? Richter, who is a very powerful. Yes. That's all he told me. Pasternak didn't really mind. Mighty hand.
Yeah.
She was charming, Tomaszewska. She also talked a great deal about Brodsky and about herself and about her father, but literary life in Russia. All these people who belong to this more or less, I don't say dissident, but non-Soviet, so to speak, group, first of all know each other, and secondly talk perfect Russian, not the kind of Russian which Soviet officials talk.
That was I was going to ask their about the Russian.
Their accent is different.
How did you feel? I mean, the Russians spoken around you. Is it the same Russian?
Well, of course it is, but the accent is exactly what would happen in England if everybody talked semi-Cockney, except those who don't. You see? And then the ambassador gave a party to which he invited a lot of Russians, both for us and mainly for the Brendels and for us. We had to be at the top of the staircase, receive them in our joint honor. And then he invited six philosophers, none of whom came. But the old various editors, the editor of Oganyok, the editor of the Literman, yes, the editor of Novomir, all these people turned up. Not especially, just because of the embassy. And various other people came. I talked to quite a lot of people there. It wasn't very interesting, it was all right. Just a party. But I got Refusnik to come. That man, I've forgotten his name, the chief Refusnik now.
Yes,
the man who met...
Yes. Reagan.
He met Reagan, yes. Yes. That's right. And what was his name? Something. The ambassador telephoned him, my request. He said, I'm on a hunger strike. So if I come, I may faint. He did come. He looked very well to me.
Well dressed?
Yes, perfectly all right. Little beard, took freely to everybody. It was quite all right. Nobody refused to speak to him. It was all perfectly all right.
Did he speak with you?
Well, very shortly. I said, what could I do for him? I said, Martin Gilbert told me about it, of course. He was on the telephone to Gilbert. For the next day, he said, very nice of me to get him asked. Did nothing but good. And then I think Bernard Levin wrote to me, also about some refusing.
Bernard Levin is...
takes an interest, yes. Absolutely.
So some Jews are now taking interest in Soviet Jewry is a substitute.
Yes. Yes. Then you needn't be a Zionist. Exactly so. What?
In many cases,
it's, yes, it's an alternative way for being a Jew. It's true of Martin Gilbert. He may be a Zionist, but the main thing is not that. He is a Zionist, but Martin Gilbert, Martin, of course.
Martin.
Yes. But still, his main interest is this other thing.
Now, did you want to see anybody that you want, that you couldn't get touch with?
Or? No, I telephoned people. Some whose telephones didn't answer. But anybody whose telephone answered, not many were perfectly prepared. The situation is easier. I'll give you the account. I was traveling from Leningrad to Moscow by plane. And I sat myself next to a man who was reading Pravda. And the man said, I saw in Pravda two car men fight each other. It rather fascinated me. When he stopped reading, he said, may I borrow a copy? He said, certainly. The two carmen turned out to be skaters who skated to the music of Carmen and had a fight. Then when I stopped reading about this, we got into conversation quite easily. He said, you read Russian? No, he didn't say that. He said, you were amused by the story? I said, yes. He said, you come from Leningrad? I said, no. You come from Moscow? No. And the silence. You come from Odessa? It's the usual thing. Yeah. Where do you come from? I come from England. Where in England? Oxford. 30 years ago, this would have produced a slight shock. They would have gone on talking. In this case, none at all. I said, do you write Moscow? He said, no, I hate Moscow. I love Leningrad for it. And then he said, what is your name? My name is Berlin. That is a Jewish name. I said, what is your name? I said, there's no Jewish name. No. He talked quite normally, as anyone might anyone. Any American could have told him. And then finally I said, they say the things are easier. Is that true? Yes, sir. For example, said I. For example, this is the first year in which we are officially allowed to know the name of Lenin's mother.
Yes, sense of humor, too.
So I said, well, it's blank, isn't it? B-L-A-N-K, yes. I said, well, there are some people in New York who say she was the daughter of a baptized Jew from Odessa. No, that is not our version, he said. What we're informed is half German, half Swedish. And I said, well, there can't be many Swedes on the Volga, really. She said, no, that is the official version. That is the true version. And that I enjoyed on. It has been published. Well, then I said to him, what about Lenin himself? Surely he was a Russian. Russian? Oh, well, you can call him that if you like. I call him a Kalmak.
Now, before I'm coming back to some other Russian questions, I have one of two questions, or two questions that I really have to ask you now. I think that when I can't recall reading in any lecture of yours or article that I read about monism, pluralism, dogmas against dogma and everything, that you refer to your attitude toward constitution. Now I'll tell you why I ask. I think that if we take into account that one of the reasons that somebody can be against monism, against dogma, and so on, is that it doesn't take into account developments, changes. I mean, one who is monist. Now, in some cases, you wouldn't.
Go on, continue.
I think that even in your lecture in Milan,
yes,
you said something people. Of the kind.
No, monists can perfectly well take account of change.
To what extent?
Well, they have to interpret it all in terms of some single system. But of course they allow change to happen. The system allows for change. Why not?
Yes.
If it's one system, it's one system.
No, certainly, but the point is that you allow for a change, but you allow for a certain change.
Well, you have to explain So now it changes. I mean, if you're a Marxist, which is my Lemonian system, changes must be accounted for. They must be explained. If it doesn't fit with your system, then presumably you may modify the system. That's allowed, provided there's only one system.
Provided only one system?
Yes.
Now, let's take into
account... It can be modified.
Let's modify the system.
Yes. But still, not so much the system is system, but still modifies the system, certainly.
Yes, all right. But don't you think that in a constitution like the American constitution, the degree of flexibility or the belief in the constitution are of the kind that they are not, I mean, that sometimes I think that there is a sort of dogmatist attitude in it.
No, all you are really saying is countries which have constitutions have some kind of unchanging rules.
Not all kinds of constitutions.
No, but the American constitution.
American is a good
example. Certain, I mean, the various points of the American constitution are various. What do they call these chapters in the Constitution? Not the amendments.
The main thing.
What are they called?
I don't know.
We're going to talk about First Amendment, Fifth Amendment.
Yes, because there's
all amendments.
Yes.
But the basic items, the basic rules of the Constitution are what they are. Certainly. And one can only alter them by all kinds of either amendments, which are allowed, or legal fictions. Which, of course, when they have done that. But, of course, constitutions are, in a sense, can be straitjackets. They can be, but they needn't be. No, I don't think I have anything to say about that.
I don't think there is a problem there. It occurred to me when I read your lecture.
Yes.
Something there reminded me of it. I'll check it again. I mean, that's
never mind
what I wanted to ask you
whatever I said,
after the lecture.
Never mind what I said.
Yes. You see, now why it bothers me? Because I think that nowadays, there are, even in Israel, there are some cases when, I mean, people are religiously in favor of a constitution, as if it's going to solve every problem. I think in some cases, it's dogmatist people who have enlightened education, and that's the way
to
preach.
I agree that there are certain people who only feel comfortable inside the monistic system. And the great people are like that at all times.
Exactly.
Constitutions suit these people particularly well, but the existence of a constitution is probably indispensable, and certainly is not in itself necessarily any kind of fetter.
No, that I agree.
On free development.
That I agree, and I...
But the taste for a constitution, on the whole, are going to people who want things cut and dried.
I mean,
temperamentally, I don't like things being cut and dried.
Yeah.
But there are people who do.
Yeah.
And they're only safe. They have security in something which they can absolutely lean on. Like, so to speak, permanent constitution.
No.
That's true.
I mean,
but why are you saying all this?
No, I'm saying all this for two reasons. A, as I said, having read your lecture in Milan, I remember that the question rose. I can't remember now the exact paragraph
maybe,
I refer to, and
maybe.
I'll check it.
All right.
But secondly, I mean, reading it, I wanted to ask you. And here I can remember a reference of yours in many places, but still, I mean, an attitude of the, let's say, the thinker on the one hand, or a man of the public on the other hand, the attitude to being, let's say, dogmatist or pluralist, monist or pluralist? Is it by its nature intellectual, moral or psychological?
All three.
All three?
Yes.
Including psychological?
Oh, certainly. Certainly, some people are more disposed towards it.
Yeah.
Psychologically, of course they are. Other people have a moral doctrine. But of course I agree with William James. I think most philosophical doctrines are traceable to psychological dispositions.
Yeah.
Fichte once said, if you want to examine a theory, you must examine the theorist.
Yeah.
Most people believe what they're inclined to believe. That inclination is a psychological attribute.
Now, can we take...
But let's go back to constitution for a moment. A constitution can be liberating. It need not be confining. If you are afraid of clerical tyranny, a secular constitution is a liberating force.
Sure.
I mean, in Israel particularly.
I know.
Any constitution which does not follow halakha is a good thing.
That's true, but I mean, one should if we come to Israel, one shouldn't fight in favor of constitution now, because politically now
it'll be the wrong constitution.
Any constitution you will produce will be bad.
Well, bad, yes. Well, that's another matter. Yes, yeah. That's another pragmatic matter.
Yeah. So, surely. No, I'm not referring to our problem.
What I
have in mind is America.
That's such. Yes. Yes. Well, but, I don't think American constitution. Of course, it is. It's prevented certain things happening, it encouraged others. But that is true of all human arrangements.
Yeah, sure. But coming back to the psychological element.
In pluralism, certainly.
Pluralism.
Oh yes, of course. People are liberals or conservatives by inclination.
Yeah.
People who like tidiness or a certain degree of untidiness by nature and so on.
Yeah.
I think William James is very good at and all that. He tends to trace fundamental beliefs, both in philosophy and in life, to, broadly speaking, certain psychological formations. There's much to be said. It doesn't mean that what these psychological formations lead to are necessarily valid or lead to truth, but they do lead to it. And if you find yourself in a certain state of mind, you can, by pure intellectual argument, sometimes be converted. But it's an uphill task.
But let's say, there is a climate. Let's say like the during the decline of the Roman Empire.
Well,
the background, the intellectual background, let's say, the moral background, the psychological background, was fertile for monistic attitude.
I have no idea. I have no idea. I know nothing about the end of the Roman Empire. No, I don't. I don't think it particularly was. I think certainly Christianity was a monistic religion. But Mithraism perhaps was not, which was a great rival.
It was
a rival to it. I have no idea. I can't tell you. I'm not historian. Nobody can give you a firm answer.
When you say you don't know, it means that you think that it's not...
No, I don't mean that. I mean, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know what the situation was. And I don't know how many people really can claim to know. It's a vast problem. The empire then was an enormous affair. And why Christianity triumphed has been explained, but never conclusively.
Of course, it can be conclusive anyway. But the idea, of course, being that during the period of transition,
why was there a period of transition? You have to say, all periods are periods of transition.
There are some that are, the transitions are more radical, and the value, and people can't cope with it, either intellectually or morally. Or
Christianity did not appear in the period of transition. It's not so. Constantine the Great was a powerful emperor. The barbarians had not broken through. There was no reason for thinking, although he moved himself to Constantinople, to say it's a period of transition more than Julius Caesar or more than I don't know the...
No, it's not the political side. I mean, the position was economic.
Spiritually, economic. I don't know particularly. Maybe.
Well, there are many theories anyway.
Exactly.
But
well, you must read Professor H.M. Jones. No. He's a man. There are at least 3 books to deal with.
I know.
And these people, I've not read them. I can't tell you what they say is plausible or not.
But let's say that...
No good asking me large historical questions.
Pardon?
Large historical questions.
I know.
I'm very well aware of my ignorance.
I think it's not the ignorance.
You are and I talking about things we don't know much about.
I know, but... Let's put the question in a different way. Do you agree that there are periods in which monistic ideology is a convenient solution for a certain kind of individual?
Certainly.
The psychological type.
Certainly.
Now, what would be the reaction of such an individual whose psychological inclinations are pluralistic, and the period is a revolutionary one, let's say the Russian Revolution? What would be the attitude of such a man?
There is no answer to that question. There is no answer. There is no answer to that question. There is no answer. The question is too personal. It depends on each person individually. No general answer would be of any value. It is true, this much seems to be true, but I'm no better on this than anybody else. My subjective view would be that people are troubled by problems and don't quite know how to conduct their lives and may have psychological inclinations in various directions. If the problems become acute and if the sense of being lost, such people often take refuge in some large system which gives them comfort, answers their questions, and they come to rest on a bed of dogma, simply because they're tired of walking.
Yeah,
and they lie down on a bed of dogma and are comfortable for the rest of their lives. That happens.
Now,
that's how people become communists.
Certainly. Now, but let's observe what's going on now in Russia.
Yes.
There is a problem there.
Many problems.
You see, for a pluralistic, do you consider Gorbachev to be pluralistic?
No, certainly not. No communist pluralistic. Gorbachev is certainly, he's an intelligent man to know that rigid dogmatism stifles progress, stifles development, stifles the imagination which is needed. He knows that. But I assume that he is some kind of communist. No communist is a pluralist. Never has been. Not possible. The whole beauty of communism is that it's solution to all problems in one way or another. When people talk about polycentrism, which George Kennan talked about, politically it makes sense that there isn't a single authority to dictate to all the communists in the world, because Yugoslavia and Romania and Russia are all somewhat different from each other. But ideologically, communism is the tightest system of the 20th century. It shows not the faintest sign of developing into some kind of system of alternatives.
Now, the question is, of course, how will Gorbachev will be judged in 50 years' time?
Neither you nor I know.
Whether the process we of decommunization started or not.
Exactly.
I mean, the feeling is that, of course, it's a tension.
I'll tell you, the position is much more, it's unanswerable, your question.
Yeah.
It's unanswerable when people speculate about it, are wasting their time, for the following reason. It seems to me that the number of persons in the Soviet Union who are convinced Marxist communists can probably be counted on the fingers at most of two hands. maybe only one. On the other hand, a number of persons who think that a radical modification is either possible or desirable is also very small. Faith in Marxism is not the same as dedication to the system which they have. I mean, Marxism to the Russians for many years has been rather like school religion to an English school, say. They go to chapel, that's our religion, they have a certain formula, they feel quite cozy about it. That's the kind of school we are, that's the religion which most boys have. But they're not bothered about dogma, they're not bothered about theology, they're not bothered about arguments in favor, arguments against. So, in that sense, the monism does not come, well, it comes from Marxism ultimately, or if it comes from Lenin or Trotsky or whoever. But now, it simply is a rigid, tight sort of straitjacket, which can be slightly modified. It can be, the body can be allowed to breathe. It can be a little bit loosened. But that's something quite different from pluralism, which allows incompatible things to coexist. And that certainly is not going to be allowed in our time, in the Soviet Union, at least in important respects. Unimportant respect, maybe.
Now, as you believe that in the formation of the attitude of the individual, psychological aspect counts.
Of course.
Why didn't you talk? You stressed that you never read Freud.
True.
Why didn't?
Ignorance. Sheer ignorance. I didn't read very much. I didn't read Freud because I didn't think in those days. Why didn't I read Freud? Because I was preoccupied with other problems and other. Other writings, that's all. I mean, I'm ashamed of not having read Freud. There's no reason in the world. I didn't react against it. I didn't think psychoanalysis is nonsense or a mere theory. I thought it might be, but I didn't read Freud for the same reasons I didn't read Principia Mathematica, because I thought it was too much to learn. And I'm by nature intellectually indolent.
It's true.
I assure you. It just seemed hard work. I always avoid that. If I possibly can. For the same reason as I wouldn't have read Marx if I didn't force myself to do it. Because I thought that the world was becoming more and more Marxist. But I had no reason for thinking the world was becoming more and more Freudian.
And you never took interest in arguments among psychoanalysts. I mean,
I knew vaguely what the differences were, just as general people, some general education do. No, I didn't take much interest in it. I thought it was something opposite. I took a very, very Philistine attitude towards it. I felt there was something in it, but not quite enough to grip me. No. I didn't read Freud because I don't think I think people who read Freud on the whole are people who are in some sense of uneasiness with themselves. I never was, I'm afraid. That's what makes my nature so exceptionally shallow. But we have shallow natures, you know. We're not profound thinkers. Above all, we're not deeply self-critical in that sense. We don't suffer from psychological malaise, which I think is the stimulus towards reading things like Freud. An interest in the unconscious must derive from some inability to cope with the conscious.
Now, most of your friends did read Freud?
I did, but most. Some certainly did. But of course, when I was young. How young?
I mean, in Oxford and the early days New College and Oxford.
Yes, certainly. I mean, undergraduates. from my time in Detroit. But it was always, I was always regarded as one theory among many. Quite interesting, quite ingenious, but I never believed that it was of central importance. That may have been wrong, because I was there, I remember, a young man called Goldschmidt, who was killed in the war, the brother of the wife of the late Professor Kaldor, who wrote an analysis of Alice in Wonderland on Freudian lines. It was quite amusing, quite well done. Stuart Hampshire, I'm sure, had Freud in those days. Something like it. Other people, though I'm just trying to think, who did I know? The philosophers didn't.
The philosophers didn't?
No. No. I think Austin dabbled in a little bit. We knew that Wittgenstein probably did. But the philosophers on their own, no. I'm trying to think who I knew.
When Freddie Ayer went to Vienna, for example.
He was totally untouched. Completely untouched by Freud. He knew the language. I mean, in the book which he wrote afterwards, he said religion was no doubt the desire for some kind of, was due to desire for a father figure. Father figure is a psychoanalytic term. We all talked about inhibitions, we all talked about, no doubt, about, certainly. About inferiority, complexes, inhibitions, and so on, that everybody talked about. Nobody quite knew what it meant. Some were Freudian, some came from Adler. Inferiority complex is not Freud. You see, and so on.
Now, another, you always said that you are not interested in, let's say, in what's going on in the Church of England, the theological arguments, it's of no interest to you.
What? Church of England?
I mean, yes.
None.
Now, what? Now, I'll tell you why I ask. I mean, nowadays, after all, it's probably the only institution in England where you find people arguing and trying to raise the argument to a level of conceptual argument. Now, truly, it's a theology.
It's no good. Look, one cannot take an interest in theology if one doesn't know what the word God means. I've never, so of course, when I was there, I understand the word God means an old man with a beard. That I understand. But that I don't believe exists. That is a very so-called primitive idea which most children and most primitive, most ordinary believers at the back of their minds probably have. Some kind of person, not unlike a human person, but great and infinitely good, infinitely powerful, infinitely etc. Once it ceases to be an old man with a beard and becomes something abstract, like a spiritual principle which governs the universe, or an occult power which in some way penetrates all there is, then I simply don't know what they're talking about. Consequently, I've never taken interest in any theology unless it impinges on something which I was interested, like, for example, Jewish history. But in the case of the Church of England, although, of course, there's a lot of argument about social problems, it doesn't seem to me that it happens at the level either of enough abstraction or enough depth to engage me. I understand what they're saying, and I sympathize with one side or the other, but I don't see how that theology helps. Atheists could argue in exactly the same terms.
Yes. That's why I ask. I mean, I can see why the theological aspect of it can deter you, but...
It doesn't deter me, but it seems irrelevant to me.
But I believe that... in many cases, scholasticism is a manifestation of sometimes a very high standard quality of mind, like, say, Thomas Aquinas.
Of course, yes.
So, now, one doesn't have to believe in Catholicism to appreciate.
Oh, no, certainly not. No. Yes, well, I'm not very interested in. If I was interested in Aristotle, I'd be interested in Aquinas. rather interested in, I don't know, the Philo. I might be interested in the Rambam, but I'm not. Just not.
Because, I mean...
I know, religion, I think, is something of interest to me, because it's certainly religious poetry, or religious phraseology, certainly touches on spiritual issues, which nothing else does, and that any atheist can appreciate. I would agree this, but any real bone-dry atheist, and I've known such people in my life, doesn't understand what people live by. They usually have a blindness to the nature of inner life on the part of human beings in general. I mean, religious language is something which undoubtedly opens the one's eyes to inner experience of a certain kind. In that sense, I'm rather pro-religion. And I think children who are educated without religion are at a grave disadvantage. It's usually put to the effect that religion is part of our culture, our civilization. All right, we'll put it that way. It's more than that. It's the attitude of atheists to society in general is very like the attitude of unmusical people towards music. They know it's important. They know people like it. They know it means a great deal, but they don't know why. Bertrand Russell, Freddie Eyre, Trevor Roper, in my opinion, gifted as they all are in many ways, have never really understood what human beings are like anywhere at any time. And that, on the whole, leads to their gravest sort of gaps in their intellectual output.
It reminds me of a minor question. In your days in Oxford, how did Catholic students feel? Did they have problems?
Catholic students in Oxford? I don't think I knew them as such. There was a Catholic chaplaincy. The Catholic chaplain was some kind of Catholic priest. At times, the Catholic priest was rather a snob, was a result of the lower-class Catholics, or Catholics from lower-class countries like Malta, didn't feel themselves fully accepted. That is what has always been alleged to be the trouble about Mintoff in Malta, who was said to have been turned anti-British by the fact that when he was at Balliol, the then-Catholic chaplain, Father de Silueta, never invited him to his parties. That was, I think, the source of resentment which probably developed.
But I mean,
they were a bit different. They were different. They were. I knew Catholics. Yes, certainly I knew Catholics. And I liked some of them. I didn't know very many, because there weren't very many.
There were
not many. No. I knew people, and I knew people in Templin Hall. I knew the Jesuits quite well. Quite well. I used to go to dinner there once a term.
When you were...
From 1932 onwards.
I see.
Even a little earlier. My last year, I knew Father Darcy, who was the head of it, who was a charming and extremely sensitive and emotionally interesting man. He had the reputation of being an important philosopher. That's what he taught. That, I think, was not founded on anything very solid. He knew Aristotle, he knew Oxford philosophy, but when Lord Hailsham, in his intellectual autobiography, explains what an influence he had on him, because he made religion intellectually respectable, he didn't make it intellectually respectable for me. Although I used to talk about it. He was like a very sensitive and charming woman, although it was delightful to talk, Father Darcy. But some of the Jesuits in his college were very intellectually tough and quite interesting to talk to.
And you could talk to them philosophically?
Oh, certainly. Yes, I could.
The Jesuits, too.
Well, I had Jesuit pupils. Yes, I taught them Plato and Aristotle. And they were very able and expounded all this very well. Sometimes I talked to them about philosophical realism. They were quite good. I knew perfectly well what they had to believe. We didn't talk about foundations of Christianity. So far as I know, they never lapsed. So I obviously didn't have a proper disintegrating influence on them.
Those are the Jesuits and others who were in the houses. Let's say Campion Hall or
the other kind of the
others.
But
an average student.
And?
I mean, an average student in your college.
Ordinary Catholics, you mean?
Yes. Were they different?
Yes, they were. They felt themselves to be different. They were not different to talk to for me, but they themselves felt a minority. Certainly. Just the Jews did.
Did any of them discuss it with you?
No.
Never.
I never brought it up. I don't think I ever brought it up. I don't think any of the Gentiles ever discussed the problem of being a Jew with me. Never. Never ever talked to me about it.
Never.
I didn't, at least, not as an undergraduate. And when I became a Don...
Even if they became intimate friends?
Yes, well, of course, I talk about Zionism to them.
But
the position of Jews, I used to lecture them on the subject. But I knew they ever asked, they brought it up, ever knew. I brought it up. I'm sure much more they did.
And girlfriends. No,
nobody said, what do you do? What is our religion? Why don't you eat pig? No, nobody said that.
Oh, let's say, but in a later age, when you had friends who knew about Judaism, but not enough, did they try to find out more?
I don't think so, no. Stuart has never in his life. Zionism, Palestine, yes. Israel, but the dogma of Judaism. He used to ask me a little bit about Spinoza, because he wrote a book about it. But mainly he got his information from the professor of Jewish studies at University College, whose name I can't remember, at that time. No. That was never an issue. I'm just trying to think. What is your anti-Semitism? I don't think I ever discussed with anybody in Oxford before the war.
Before the war?
Yes, after the war.
Before the war, I mean, when Nazism rose,
no.
Anti-Semitism was not...
No. I never met anybody who was pro-Nazi in Oxford. They may have existed, of course they existed, but I don't think I knew them.
But people who came back from
Germany. The only time I remember when the issue of Jew came up was Quentin Hogg, now Lord Hilsch, in 1938, said to me, you want a war because you're a Jew. That's why you want to fight against the Nazis. Well, we don't want a war here. You just wanted, you didn't say bloody Jew, and that's what it meant. Then, 9 months later, I said, I want to kill Germans. I want to kill a great many Germans. I want to kill them with my own hands. So his opinion changed within 2 or 3 months.
You had friends who went to Germany to study German?
No, I don't think I did. I don't think I ever did. I don't think anybody from Oxford, to my knowledge. I had a pupil called Monty Wutthaus, who was afterwards a politician. He went to Munich, 1938 or so, and he used to tell me how delightful the Hofbrauer house was in Munich. He liked Germany, didn't like France, but we didn't talk about politics.
No, but friends, who went to study there?
Philosophy, no.
German or philosophy?
No, nobody did. Not in my time. John Michael Foster, before my time, studied philosophy in Kiel, before the Nazis.
Crossman then?
Crossman did go, yes. That's quite right. He talked about Germans non-stop. I never had an argument about the Nazis with him, because there was no point. Crossman professed to be anti-Nazi, and up to a point was, but basically, he was a left-wing Nazi. He was anti-capitalist, but he believed in marches and flags, and he was absolutely fascinated by them. And they used to come and visit him here. And they used to tell them how terrible they were, and they were very, very, they were delighted. The tone was right. His appearance was right. His interests were right. They didn't mind being denounced. The right was done in a fashion which they understood and which was cozy for them. And he loved the Germans. And he did. He denounced the Nazis, but they felt a brother. The bullying aspect, the passion, and the interest, the overwhelming interest, what they were, what they believed, moved them very much. And the little Nazi groups sometimes came here.
But Nazism was an issue. I mean, because of appeasement or...
Not in Oxford, it wasn't. No. I mean, of course, yes, but I don't remember any sharp arguments, say, in all zones, for and against. I remember Hubert Anderson denouncing the Foreign Office to Roger Makins because we allowed Hitler to reoccupy the Rhineland.
Yeah, that's
that kind of thing.
Politics,
yes, but ideologically, there was nobody here who's professor who appeared to be pro-Nazi.
No, but anti, I mean the anti-Nazi.
They had nobody to argue against.
I mean,
we knew perfectly well there were appeasers, of course.
Yeah.
But there never was a collision. People just knew how people were. It never came to what might be called a sharp argument. Not in my presence, at least. Someone like Rouse, the left-wing, would hear those bloody Germans, bloody Huns, bloody Nazis, and people who, on the other side, just listened and probably shrugged their shoulders, went to the other end of the room.
But he was anti-Nazi because he was left.
Yes, yes.
I mean, anti-Semitism had nothing to do.
He's rather anti-Semitic himself.
No. Yeah. But, I mean, others among your friends, I mean, who were leftists and anti-Nazis and so on, anti-Semitism didn't come into it in the
70s,
like only after the war.
If at all, yes.
No, after
certainly,
the war.
Certainly. After the war, certain word of anti-Zionism. But anti-Semitism was never, I never came across anti-Semitism in an overt sense. I mean, far less than anybody else you know.
That's my feeling.
It is so. Nobody in summer, I don't know why, I've never been present when people uttered unsuitable anti-Semitic sentiments.
Less than many others.
Well, probably. Probably. I dare say in Oxford, these things are rather muted. Of course, someone like Lionel Curtis, who was a great British imperialist and a racist fundamentally, didn't like Jews, but never said so in my presence. The word was never uttered. When I was elected to All Souls, the Bishop of Gloucester, during the meeting which I was elected, made a speech saying, after all, we are a Christian foundation. Perhaps it isn't right, but I'm certainly the first Jew to be elected, a kind of, to fellowship, ordinary fellowship of a college. But, I don't know, I probably brought 5 votes to my side.
Was he a fellow of the college?
Yes, he was.
And he was
certainly. As to, we became great friends, all great friends. He talked very amiably to me.
Yes, I mean, it doesn't imply anti-Semitism.
No. Well, I think he perhaps was a little bit. He might have been. He was very reactionary. And I dare say he could have been called. But he wasn't interested in Jews. It wasn't a subject. Let me explain to you. In general, England is not an anti-Semitic country. In this sense. A country is not anti-Semitic if you assume about it.